recently watching, catching up on the first season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel with my wife as we are preparing. The second season just came out this last week. It's a good show. If you're somebody that's looking for a show, this is one that I generally recommend, knowing that TV taste is a very kind of tricky thing. But I was rewatching it, and there's a scene from the very first episode that I just thought was so interesting, and it stuck with me in a pretty profound way. It's a scene where Miss Maisel and her husband had just gone out the night before. The kids are out of the house, and they're like in bed. It's morning, and she wakes up while he is still sleeping and sneaks off into the other room. She sneaks off into the other room, and she does her hair, and she does her makeup, and she puts perfume on, and like totally puts herself together. And then climbs back into bed and pretends to be asleep, because then a minute later the alarm goes off. And then the husband wakes up and rolls over, and she pretends like she has just woken up too, where in fact she spent the last hour putting herself together in the morning. And I think the reason why this stuck with me, there's something about this scene that I think it almost captured a general human experience. That maybe kind of that gets communicated, I think, certainly for us here in America, that in some ways the goal is to look as put together as possible without looking like you're trying too hard. That it's almost like we wake up beautiful and put together. And I think this is part of being human, the desire to present strength or skill or aptitude or looking like we have it put together. You know, throughout my life, I do feel like I've been taught to like always put my best foot forward. Like I feel like a lot of my life has been learning how to draw attention to my skills, draw attention to my areas of competency, draw attention to my strengths, and in turn hide my weaknesses from the spotlight. I feel like that's like one of those things as I grow older, is learning how to draw attention to the better places of me. And so when I come across something I didn't understand, I think back in life, and I think about when I was in school, and I come across something I didn't get. I actually learned it went way better for me if I pretended I did and then just BS'd my way through it than the times I actually admitted I didn't get it. It just seemed like I was more rewarded for pretending like I did, if I could get away with it. Or once I started working, I looked around at the people that I saw getting promoted. And like frequently those getting promoted were not actually necessarily the most skilled or capable people. It was those that were good at drawing attention to their successes. It was those that were good at highlighting their skills and got good at kind of distracting from their weaknesses. Or even think about relationships, like particularly when I was younger, where these kind of parts of identity and parts of worldview were first being formed. Who were the people that seemed to be most popular? Who were those that seemed to be most successful in romance? It certainly wasn't the nicest people. It wasn't the smartest people. And actually, it wasn't even always the most attractive people. It was people who seemed confident. Like those that seemed to just have it together and were able to kind of project that to the world. And I say, I don't think this is like a 100% bad thing. Understanding your strengths and your weaknesses, and learning how to lean into your strengths, I think is a helpful thing. Like, I'm not saying that this is writ large bad. But I think we all, on some level, also acknowledge it to be exhausting. At least I feel exhausted trying to pretend I'm put together. I feel drained by trying to imagine how I'm being perceived. I feel worn out with the sense that I should be more put together than I am. So I don't know if you caught the opening video. It was on imposter syndrome. It's the psychology that most people in some area actually feel kind of in over their heads. That even qualified people, like there are examples of Mary Angelou and Einstein, the people who are qualified can feel like in some ways they are faking it. That I'm not as capable as people think I am. And that there's anxiety in some way that maybe other people will find this out. And the fear of being found out causes stress and anxiety and ultimately prevents people often from enjoying their successes. It's hard to feel successful if you secretly think, maybe I didn't fully deserve this. or maybe other people don't realize how much I'm actually just making this up as I go along. You know, I resonate with this a lot for many reasons. I am one that is known for making things up as I go along, starting sentences before I know the ending of sentences. I will often give checklists, like I have 3 ideas on this and have not actually thought out how many ideas I have, but now I must come up with 3 or take my 5 ideas and somehow, like, so this one's actually 1A. But I also feel about, I feel this in many ways, but being here today, I feel this as a pastor. Yeah, I'd say probably once every month or two, I have this moment where I like, I wonder if other pastors just have it a little more put together than I do. Like, I wonder if they feel, like, more certain that the advice they're giving is actually good. I wonder if they feel more capable. I wonder if they don't struggle with the doubts that I struggle with. I wonder if they have, like, some kind of divine clarity where God has reassured them that everything they've said is correct. You know, and I've come to think about this is realizing that I think this in some way points to the fact that church, faith, in America is really in a lot of ways just like the rest of our world. It's full of messages that communicate that we should be more put together than we are. The funny part is I'm a child of a pastor, grandchild of a pastor. I've spent my life around pastors, and I think the biggest thing I've noticed is how ridiculously flawed they are. And feeling frustrated at how do people think that, you know, you grow up with a life of like, you're so lucky to have your dad. And I feel lucky to have my dad. But as a 13-year-old, you don't always feel lucky that that person's your dad. And there's something I think true of all public life, and in a weird way is true in church as well, is that the people up front, it's not just like I've spent time to think about this. It's that I'm in some way more arrived. And the thing I can say definitively is that's not true of me. And the other thing I can say pretty definitively is it's not true of most pastors. But I think it is true that our current culture of church communicates that spiritual growth and feeling arrived are the same thing. And this is often one thing I feel very frustrated about. When I look at like the wider Christian landscape of America, something that really tends to get under my skin a lot, and it's pretty easy to find, is pictures and examples of something I think much of American Christianity has just embodied, which is a narrative of our world that positions Christians as the hero of the story. And I think that this narrative that Christians are the heroes, that the Christians are the ones that have it figured out, I think it promotes the same kind of marvelous Miss Maisel behavior that's already prominent. Like, what are the examples that get told in church? Usually it's like the time that person did something great, overcame. How, despite the threats faced to them, they found victory. And I think what often happens is it promotes the same thing the rest of life promotes. Hide your weaknesses. Hide your doubts. Vince and I are laughing. Hide your women. Hide your... No, so it's a... we last night, if you're... I was like, the funny part is that's like a weird niche of somebody, you had to have been a certain age at a certain time for that to feel, it doesn't matter. We'll move forward here. It promotes something that says that you need to act certain, pretend like you have it figured out, pretend like you don't wake up as much of a hot mess as everybody else. And the problem I find with telling a story where you are the hero, is it forces your attention to things that make you look heroic. And it draws your attention away from the places you need to be challenged. And thus we interpret the world through heroic eyes. It's not that you're stubborn and unwilling to listen to divergent ideas. No, it's that you're courageous and you stand up for your beliefs. You're not willing to give in to the enemy. It's not that you judge or demonize or exclude others. No, it's you stand for truth. It's not that you belittle and condescend those around you that think differently. No, it's you're the hero who's benevolently trying to help others find the arrival you already have. And I find it strange that we're so prone to think of ourselves as the heroic ones in an attempt to follow Jesus. And I find it strange and inappropriate, especially in light of reading the Bible. That time and time again, we look at the Bible. You think about this. How many pictures of the Bible is it people just getting things wrong? Messing up. You think about like Israel's history is not one of how they got things right. Largely it's like, look at all of the examples of how we got things wrong. And who are the heroes of the faith? You know, like Joseph, David, younger sons, not the ones meant to have power. You think about the cultural context, and you think about God working through widows, God working through women who are barren. Or my favorite picture, or you even think about much of the New Testament written by Paul, somebody who himself calls himself the worst among us. Or if you've ever read the Gospels and actually thought about how the disciples are depicted, so like they're the ones that are recording the events. I think if I was recording the events, I would have painted a more flattering picture of myself. But I think that's where God comes in, because that's not the point. They're often depicted as somewhat fumbling and often confused people who are often getting things wrong. And in fact, I would say some of the most profound teachings of Jesus are in response to how wrong the disciples understood something. That they were like so off base and so missing the point. He was like, all right, guys, listen up. Let me teach you something. And yet, this, as the basis of how we understand faith today, we've come to the conclusions that we're the heroes of the story. And I say this all to say that actually now, when I think about this kind of monthly or bi-monthly questioning of myself, when I ask, am I really put together enough to do this? You know, this monthly struggle with doubt, this monthly realization of how many weaknesses and shortcomings I really have, how far I have to go in my life to be the person that I truly want to be. I've actually find that that helps me find Jesus more. That strangely enough, this imposter syndrome that I experience, I think in some ways makes me a better pastor. I think this all feels appropriate to think about right now as we enter the second Sunday of what's known as Advent. It's the 4 weeks leading up to Christmas. It's meant to be a time of preparation for celebrating God coming to humanity in the birth of Jesus. A celebration of a God that chose to be born in a stable of a humble couple in strained circumstances, far from home and out of money, that the God of the universe chose to communicate the great mystery of his love and mercy by sending us the least threatening, the least strong, the least put together divine presence we can imagine, a small child totally dependent on his parents. I think I find the message of Christmas, of God coming to us in such humble circumstances, to be so meaningful, because it's counter to all the other narratives I experience. And this is why I think it's so good for our souls to revisit the Christmas story and the events around Christmas each year. Because as familiar they might be to us, like we've heard the stories, we have familiarity with it. I think in terms of how we actually live, they're quite foreign. You know, one of the events around the Christmas story that's often visited this time of year is the prayer that Mary, Jesus' mother, prayed upon finding out she was pregnant with Jesus. It's called the Magnificat. We as a church have actually revisited this prayer every year of our existence in some way, shape, or form. And I think we do so because I think it's a beautiful example of what faith can look like. It's a beautiful and often, I think, maybe the first example of somebody knowingly trying to follow Jesus. What did that heart look like? How did that manifest itself? And so what I'd like to do is I want to read this. So you just imagine where we are in the story. Mary has just realized that she's pregnant. She has found out. She's just been visited by the angel to let her know what's going on. And then this is her first response to this. This is from Luke 1. Oh, how my soul praises the Lord. How my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he took notice of his lowly servant girl. And from now and on, all generations will call me blessed. For the Mighty One is holy, and he has done great things for me. He shows mercy from generation to generation to all who fear him. His mighty arm has done tremendous things. He has scattered the proud and haughty ones. He has brought down princes from their thrones and exalted the humbled. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away with empty hands. He has helped his servant Israel and remembered to be merciful, for he made his promise to our ancestors, to Abraham and his children forever. I just always loved this prayer. As soon as I kind of encountered this as an adult life, I think in a strange way, it actually describes more accurately than most my experience of faith. That when I embrace my need, when I acknowledge my shortcomings, that is when I most find the help, validation, guidance, healing, and support that God has for me. I mean, just like, listen to the words that she says. He took notice of his lowly servant girl. He has done great things for me. His mercy extends. He scatters the proud, lifts up, exalts the humble, fills the hungry, helped his servant, been merciful, and fulfills his promises. There is an embrace of weakness, need. She is not striving to prove herself, jockeying for position. She's not keeping score with the world. She is open and vulnerable and soft. Richard Rohr is a Catholic thinker whom we tend to quote fairly often, as we tend to be one of my favorite writers on spirituality today. And there's an excerpt from something he wrote that I think gets at the heart of Mary's prayer. Actually, I think it gets at the heart of Christmas, Jesus' birth. It really gets at the heart of Jesus' life and death and resurrection. It gets at the heart of what this whole thing is about in respects to Jesus. He says, it takes all of us a long time to move from power to weakness, from glib certitude to vulnerability, from the meritocracy to oceans of grace. Strangely enough, this is especially true for people raised in religion. In Paul's letters, he's consistently idolizing not power, but powerlessness, not strength, but weakness, not success, but the cross. It's as if he's saying, I glory when I fail and I suffer, because now I get to be like Jesus, the naked loser, who turned any notion of God on its head. Now losers can win, which is just about everyone. The revelation of the death and resurrection of Jesus forever redefines what success and winning means. And it's not what any of us wanted or expected. On the cross, God is revealed as vulnerability itself. Actually, the Latin word vulnus means wound. The path to holiness is so different than any of us would have wished or imagined. And yet after the fact, we will all recognize that it was our littleness, our wrongness, that kept the door open to union and love, permanently wedged open every day of our life. In fact, there's no way to close it. Today, so often look for hope and strength, success, power, being put together like Mrs. Maisel. I know for me at least, I often associate the life that I want. Like when I imagine, what is the life that I really desire? And it's a life with plenty of resources. It's a life with power and privilege, with success and comfort. But that's why I'm thankful we revisit this every year in the season of Advent. Because I think it invites us to consider a subtle inversion of value, a flipping of the script, that power is born of weakness, strength of humility. It is not strength or self-reliance that lead us into life. It is humility and the acknowledgement of our need for help. In fact, this is actually at the heart of why Vince and I long ago even dreamed of starting a church like this. We were sitting there kind of before the church was even a glimmer of an idea. And we were praying together. And we felt like God kind of laid out a heartbeat. If you were to ever do something, I think this needs to be at the center, kind of that thing. And the heartbeat was true and honest humility. That finding the help we need in life, finding the validation we desire, the connection and the depth of life that I think we long for, it begins with humility. It begins with the softening of our own hearts to say, yeah, I don't have it figured out. I am limited. I have flaws. I do fail. And it is this which opens up the door to everything that Jesus offers. And so we began planning this, start a church, started to dream of what this would look like, because we wanted more people to experience the amazingness of the humility Jesus led us to. I think the truth is we didn't find humility at the center point of too many other things we were pursuing in life. And so we thought, what if we started a place where humility was the beginning point, the awareness of our need? Because we wanted more people to experience all that we had found, to experience what we think Mary's prayer lays out for us. You know, I do love the quote that Rohr gives. And there's a phrase in there that I think is powerful. It says, losers can now win, which is just about everybody. But I think the truth is, losers can lose too. I have felt losing to lose before. What I mean by this is my own weakness, my own flaws, my many failures, making me feel worse about who I am. That my flaws often isolate me. It makes me feel less lovable. It makes me question my worth. I would actually say this is probably our default experience as humans. I think it's why we are prone to hide the things about us that aren't put together. I think it's why we are prone to resonate with waking up an hour before our spouse gets up to try to look pretty. So I think if you're somebody who just feels aware of your flaws, you feel aware of your failure and your need, I think it is likely that there's some people here that it's not a long stretch of the imagination to say I'm a flawed person. And the truth is that feels crappy. And when that leads you to hiding, when that leads you to withdrawing, when that leads you to isolating yourself or lashing out or self-hate, then I think losing to lose is what we find. But I think what Jesus leads us toward, it's at the heart of his message, and actually what I think Jesus, what Rohr is referencing when he says losers can win, is that when we feel weak, when we feel need, it's actually there that we have the opportunity to find the kind of validation and acceptance that we truly need. That actually being in a place of weakness, being familiar with weakness, in that we can find true belonging. In fact, true belonging is in some ways only able to be found from a place of weakness. I think this is because when we find love and acceptance in the midst of our weakness, we know that it's not love that comes on the condition of our performance. It's not love that comes on the condition of our strength or aptitude. We find that it's not love that is conditional. You know, I think of that scene where she pretends to be fully done before she gets up for the day. And it does capture something, I think, of how we feel in life. That in the end, we will just be more loved when it looks like we're put together without having to work too hard for it. The truth is, I long to be loved when I'm a mess. When I look up and my hair is all over the place, my breath stinks, I'm wearing my like t-shirt from high school that has become a midriff. And in fact, it's when we're loved, when we're a hot mess, when we're unkept, when we are undone, and then in that still met with love, I think it's only then that we begin to tear down all of the fear, tear down the doubt, tear down the sense that the love we receive is fleeting or unreliable, something we must continue to perform to keep. And that is why Mary's prayer is so powerful to me, because she is in touch with the fact that she is loved by God and in touch with the fact that she has done nothing to deserve it. And that doesn't leave her feeling indebted or insecure. It leaves her feeling grateful and invited into a story so much bigger than her. So I do hope that a little bit today, everybody here can experience this. But I think Rohr is also right in saying it takes us a long time to move from power to weakness. Actually, I think it's like a whole lifetime effort. Trying to lean into our weakness, I think, is something that we never quite arrive to. But there's been a handful of times, maybe half a dozen times in my life, where I felt like in a moment of prayer, I was able to lay myself out as a hot mess. I was able to be like undeniably broken, undeniably weak. There's like no way you were going to see me at that place and say, based on meritocracy, I have it. And then felt in a strange interactive way met. Overcome with I'm loved. Feel like God was with me in that moment, almost like internalizing a sense of acceptance. As I said, I've experienced this a handful of times in my life, which is awesome. In a moment, we are going to pray. I'm going to pray that somebody in this room does experience a sense of being loved unconditionally. But I will say, actually, most frequently, I have experienced this reality of God meeting me through other people. I frequently feel like God has most profoundly communicated his love and unconditional acceptance of me in the face of my need, in the face of my failure, through the words and affection of those in my life. And so what I want to leave you with here today, this is not like you are there. This is a lifetime process. But if you were like, I like this, how do I do this? What does this look like? What's a step towards this? I want to suggest an exercise. The first step of the exercise is to find somebody who you trust and has earned your trust. Somebody that you can be vulnerable with and it feels safe to do so. And this is a three-part exercise. The first one is to share. So just to tell your partner about an area of weakness, failure, need, or insecurity. So whatever feels pressing. And I would say pay attention. What's the thing that you're like, if somebody knew this, they would probably think less of me. That feels too big, maybe just, yeah, that was not really painting me in the best light. And tell them, say, I got really overwhelmed a week ago, and I totally blew off some responsibilities that I was supposed to do. Tell them I got angry and treated somebody underneath me at work poorly because I was angry about my life. Tell them I feel insecure about how much money I have. Tell them I fear that people don't actually like me very much. And then have them reflect what you said back to you. Whatever you shared. So I hear you saying, you don't actually think people like you very much. So I hear you saying that last week you treated a subordinate poorly at work because you were feeling stressed. There's something powerful in hearing those things reflected. And if they get it wrong, correct them. Like if they haven't, like, you know what, that's actually not quite it. It's not that. What it really is I feel like a failure because I couldn't control my emotions. Like, or something like that. You clarify it. And then, as the third step, ask them to tell you that they love you. Receive from your partner that you are loved by them and by God. So maybe the way this would go is if I was doing this with Vince, I would say, you know, I feel like a failure because I was unable to control my emotions and got angry and treated somebody poorly who was a subordinate at work. It's not the kind of person I am. I want to hide that, but it happened. Vince might then return to me and say, I hear you saying that you feel like a failure. You want to hide the fact that you treated somebody poorly because you were dealing with stress and weren't able to control your emotions. And then have him turn around and say, I hear that. I love you. God loves you. And I think there's something powerful in that interaction. There's something powerful in saying, you just saw the part that I feel afraid for people to see and still validated me. And I think that's a little bit of what it looks like to live out of our weakness. And I'm just gonna say, hands down, the experience of love and acceptance, the like, I'm getting what I need in my life, is gonna be so much better there than if I went to Vince and said, dude, I think I did a really kick-ass job on my talk that week. And he's like, you know what, you did. I hear you saying you did a kick-ass job. And I'm like, I did a kick-ass job. And he's like, all right, well, you know what, I love you for that awesome job you did. I'm like, thank you. I think one of those two is experienced different. And I think one of those two is the life that I think Jesus is really trying to lead us into, one where our needs are actually met. So once I said, this is an incredibly vulnerable thing to do. So don't just do this with anybody. It needs to be somebody that's trusted, somebody that's shown trustworthiness in this. Because if you say this to the wrong person, they're like, you know what? I'm happy you brought that up. Because I have this other thing that I've seen you do that's terrible too. That's not helpful. But as Rohr said, God is revealed as vulnerability itself. Vulnerability, wound. You know, we will all recognize in the end that it was our littleness and wrongness that kept the door open to union and love. Now, that is where I want us to live out of. If you feel weak, if you feel crappy, if you don't love your life right now, if you feel like, what am I doing here? If you feel ashamed, if you feel like, I'm not totally sure I really am what people think I am. The message to you is awesome place to receive love. You have an opportunity. You are not so far away from the life you desire. It's not like you have to get things together, be put together, and then arrive, and then you get a life of depth, fullness, and connection. You have it available right now. And so what I'd love to do is invite everyone to stand with me, and we're going to pray. I'm going to pray for that right now. Jesus, I am so thankful that the way you came to reveal your love for us was not as some triumphant, kingly, fully developed warrior that showed his strength and power and dominion, but rather you came as a helpless child to a family without money and resources in a foreign land, and that your life culminated in victory through betrayal and defeat. And I pray that each of us here could meet you as Mary first met you, aware of our need, not hiding, not feeling the sense that we have to be more put together. And I ask right now, if anybody is feeling resonance with this, to, in your mind, say, this is the thing I'm afraid of. This is my need, my weakness, my fear, my insecurity, my failure. The thing you would, you know, hide on the job interview of life. And just offer it in your mind to God. And now, Jesus, I ask in return, we would feel loved. Oh, yeah, that sucked. Guess what? I really love you. Dude, that's super hard. I love you. Wow. I see all that shame you feel. I love you. You don't need to feel that shame. I see how that fear is swirling in your mind. Know that you are loved.